And we will indeed be talking about the music and life of Paul Simon in this hour. His creativity and durability are nothing short of remarkable. He's made significant musical contributions in several decades and is still recording and performing. Paul Simon long ago shook the need to have "And Garfunkel" after his name for people to know who he was. He's the subject of a new biography by Peter Ames Carlin called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. Peter Ames Carlin is a name familiar to longtime readers of The Oregonian. He worked there for years as a TV columnist and feature writer. Peter also worked as a senior writer at People magazine, and he's the author of previous music biographies on Brian Wilson, Paul McCartney, and Bruce Springsteen. Peter Ames Carlin, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Is this the first major biography of Paul Simon?
Well, yeah. I mean, there have been some smaller ones that came out. You know, there's a couple good books, about Simon and Garfunkel and one about Paul that came out in England quite a while ago now. But in terms of books in America, I think it really is. I was stunned. I set out and thought about writing about Paul, you know, four years ago when I finished the Springsteen book. And I did a little research and tried to find a good authoritative book, you know, that covered Paul in some depth. And it just wasn't out there. And I was like, well, you know, so I put on my Lone Ranger mask and came galloping in, you know.
Has Paul Simon himself been somewhat resistant to being covered in a biography?
Well, somewhat is not accurate. Resistant is extraordinarily accurate, yes. Very accurate. I mean, he had kind of a philosophical resistance to people writing biographies about him. And, you know, it was disappointing to me because I knew, having worked so closely with Bruce Springsteen and his management and so many people at Columbia Records, which is, you know, where Paul recorded for a huge chunk of his career, I thought, you know, there was going to be some easy connections and we'd at least be able to talk about it a little bit. But Paul is very control-oriented and very made it very clear very instantly that he had no interest in that happening. And so there we were.
Wow. So, but his music certainly speaks for itself. I want to let people hear possibly the first thing that that Paul ever published. This is something he wrote at age 13 called The Girl For Me. And here's a little clip of him performing that.
The girl for me is standing there. That's the one. Flowers in her hair. I'll always love her, and I know she'll be true. She'll be true.
So it's obviously Paul Simon as an older man performing a song he wrote when he was very young. It sounds like for all his talent, though, Peter, that Paul was somewhat ambivalent about music. What did he really see as his ultimate goal?
Well, I think he always knew or felt deep down that he had to be a lifetime musician. I think he actually co-wrote that tune with Artie. I think that very early, from the time they were about 13 years old, they were writing these songs together. And then, you know, Paul's dad was a professional musician, and he had a very good friend, a father of another friend of his, who worked in the music industry and actually ran a record label. And between them, I think, you know, he had learned exactly what to do. You know, you send a lead sheet to the Library of Congress and get it copyrighted, and then he would take the songs, he and Artie would take them into Midtown, New York, and try to get them sold. But at the same time, his father, who had quit music by this point and went back to school and got a graduate degree and eventually a doctorate in education, was urging Paul to, like, not become a musician at all. You know, he wanted his son to be a lawyer or a businessman or something, you know, respectable, or a teacher, you know, which is what his father eventually became. But, you know, Paul, you know, he went to college. He was the president of his fraternity. He did very well in college. He tried going to law school, but he couldn't stand it. And really what he wanted to do was the job that he had been pursuing on the side, even when he was in college, writing songs and trying to get them recorded and writing songs for other people and recording demos for other songwriters. You know, for a time he worked as the head of A&R, Artist and Repertoire, for a small New York label called Amy Records. He also worked at the Edward Marks Publishing Company, one of the oldest and most successful publishing companies out there. as a song plugger, trying to get tunes recorded and making the rounds of record companies and producers and managers. So he was very involved in every element of the music industry, you know, from a very young age. But still, I think the thing that kept him going the most, the thing that turned him on the most, was writing and performing music.
Well, and they did that, he and Art Garfunkel together, although not as Simon and Garfunkel, but as Tom and Jerry. And here's the first single they put out as teenagers called Hey Schoolgirl.
Ooh-ba-ba-loo-cha-ba, you're mine. Say, ooh-ba-ba-loo-cha-ba, you're mine. Hey, schoolgirl in the second row. The teacher's looking over, so I got to whisper way down low.
You have to listen carefully to hear the Simon and Garfunkel voices in there, but that's clearly them. Why Tom and Jerry and not their own names, although I can guess the answer?
Well, you know, I mean, back in those days, pretty much everybody used, you know, there were a lot of stage names being used. It was an old, you know, sort of standby thing in popular culture for actors and actresses, but particularly for, you know, stars and music stars who had ethnic names. And so since the names Simon and Garfunkel were so obviously Jewish at the time, that was just unacceptable. I mean, in mainstream American culture, unfortunately, Paul's dad, Lou Simon, had a music career as a you know, as a session musician and a performer on TV shows, and he went by the name Lee Sims, even though obviously his real name was Lou Simon.
Because he couldn't.
So when Paul and Artie were offered this deal, it made perfect sense for them to want to take on these stage names.
Tom Graf and Jerry Landis. We'll learn more about them and how they did as Tom and Jerry, and where Paul Simon's life moved from there. Peter Ames Carlin is our guest. He's the author of Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. We'll come back and talk more about the book and hear more about the music, hear more of the music, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking to Peter Ames Carlin, longtime reporter and feature writer and columnist for The Oregonian in Portland. Still living in Portland, but working on other materials these days, including a brand new biography of Paul Simon called Homeward Bound, in which he discusses the career of Paul Simon at some length and obviously with great resistance from Paul Simon himself, but it's a well-told story. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to when the guys who became known as the teen idols, Tom and Jerry, Simon and Garfunkel, met. It sounds like Paul actually heard Art sing when they were in the same school in fourth grade.
Yeah, you know, they were having an assembly. It was kind of the spontaneous thing because the school buses that were supposed to take the kids home were late. They got hung up somewhere else, you know, in traffic. And so instead of just having the kids running around going berserk in the playground, the teachers called everyone together and had an assembly, and they were just looking for people to help fill the time, you know, until the buses rolled into town. And somebody, Artie's teacher, remembered how much he liked to sing and occasionally would stand up and entertain the class. So she said, well, maybe, you know, Artie wants to sing a song. And of course he did. He jumped up on stage and sang a Nat King Cole song. And Paul, sitting in the audience, was struck by how instantly the entire crowd just hushed. And you could hear a pin drop as Artie, in this beautiful, rich voice he had even then, sang the song in this very moving way. And then Paul in the crowd is looking around and noticing, you know, not only all the kids so quiet, but the girls in the audience were just, you know, spellbound. And he thought to himself, as he said later, like, wait a minute, I want to get me some of this too, you know. And he was already interested in playing guitar and interested in music. And that kind of started his, you know, his interest in Artie as a person, and led within a couple years to their friendship, which became very significant for both of them. And they very soon began to work on music together. and you know, began writing songs. And by the time they were 13, they were getting them copyrighted and traveling on the subway to Midtown Manhattan to try to get them get the interest of record labels and producers. And then by the time they were 16, they had their first hit, you know, that Hey Schoolgirl song we wrote about.
Wow, 16 years old, and they got an American Bandstand and everything.
Yeah, with Jerry Lee Lewis, you know. I mean, they were both sort of astonished and thrilled and terrified to do it. But, you know, the interesting thing is when Dick Clark was asking them about themselves, as he did to performers, you know, well, where are you guys from? And, you know, Artie said he was from Queens and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when Dick Clark put the microphone in front of Paul, he said he was from Memphis for some damn reason. But, you know, which is sort of bizarre. I guess he was trying to associate himself with Elvis to some degree and create a bit of a mystique. But it also sort of shows, I mean, they were already working under pseudonyms, and Paul would work under a whole variety of other names. I mean, he released songs as True Taylor, as Jerry Landis. When he turned to folk music, he began to call himself Paul Kane. It sort of points to, I think, a lot of the immigrant experience that they both had as being the sons and grandsons of people who had come from Central and Eastern Europe to America in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that sort of their family's path from orthodoxy to assimilation, which is a very common American story. It's like one of the classic American experiences, is also very much about identity and the change of identity and of embracing this American idea of you can be whoever you want. So, you know, Paul Simon / Jerry Landis standing up on Tom on American Bandstand, if he wants to, he can be from Memphis.
Right.
He says he was from Memphis.
So they got an American Bandstand, and interesting that they had endorsed the check back to Dick Clark, because that's how payola worked. That was a really interesting wrinkle in there. But so were they sort of like the fictional wonders of that thing you do? I mean, did they have this one hit and then fizzle after that?
They fizzled for some time. I mean, even though they both, you know, they kind of went their separate ways, there was a sort of the original sin in the famously operatic relationship of Paul and Artie can actually be traced back to right when they were putting together the recording deal to, you know, with the record company that wanted to put out a Hey Schoolgirl, because Paul and his father did the negotiation for Paul and Artie. And they arranged with this record company owner to hammer out a side deal, a secret side deal for Paul to start a solo career with the company, even as, you know, he and Artie were about to record their first song together.
So the True Taylor entity, was that who that was?
True Taylor entity, yeah.
We actually have a clip. I can't believe that this is actually Paul Simon, but I want to hear a little bit of True or False by the so-called True Taylor.
Oh, yes, please.
It's hard to believe that is Paul Simon, but you can really hear the Paul Simon vocal tone in there.
Yeah, he sounds like Elvis Presley's like less smart cousin or something. And the interesting thing is his dad wrote that song, Lou Simon, who at the time was both working as a musician, but also back in graduate school, getting a graduate degree in education, and he would soon start a career as a teacher because he was sick of music. So you have this odd kind of you have this odd thing where it's written like somebody who's writing a test, which generally was not something children, teenagers thought about very much. And Paul doing this, his sort of Elvis, kind of Elvis Buddy Holly, called it, you know, the hiccups and the, you know, that kind of stuff. It sounds ridiculous, but it was a huge flop. But the fact that he put that out, you know, sort of behind Artie's back, infuriated Artie and is really the seed of the distrust and the kind of love-hate thing between them that continues to this day.
So they told people they didn't speak for 5 years. Did you find that to be true based on the people you talked to?
No, that's completely false. You know, I mean, it's a great story, right? They didn't talk for 5 years, but they still lived in the same neighborhood, and they saw each other. And not only that, they would play occasional shows as Tom and Jerry. You know, they play. You know, Lou Simon started working at a junior high school in New York City, and the kids there hired Tom and Jerry to be to sing at their fall 1962 sock hop. And there's pictures of that, and Paul's college friends remember him talking about his friend Artie, and they didn't see him very often, but Paul was clearly still close to him and clearly in touch with him. So, you know, and I'm sure they were more distant than before, and they went to separate schools and had separate friends, but they both were in school in New York. You know, Paul was at Queens College, Artie was at Columbia University. And so, you know, they make up the story, the slightly more kind of glam story of them accidentally bumping into each other on a bridge, you know, after 5 years, and then reigniting their friendship after, you know. So it's you know, they take the essence of the truth and they blow it up into something else altogether different.
I like your description of it as an operatic sort of relationship.
Yeah, very much so. You know, the other thing that's interesting, and we were talking earlier about identity and pseudonyms and stuff, is that even when they started performing as Simon and Garfunkel, they were pretty intent on staying away from their natural, you know, Jewish names. And so at first they called themselves Cain and Gar. And then when Paul went to England and sort of became successful there, even with his regular name, he decided to stick with Simon. But when he performed with Artie, he didn't want Artie to be Garfunkel, because that was way too Jewish as far as he was concerned. And so at first it was Cain and Gar, and then for a while they tried Cain and Garfield, and finally it was a vice president at Columbia Records at a meeting who said, "Look, it's 1964, you're going to be Simon and Garfunkel, and that's it," you know. And so they tell the story completely differently, but it took that authority to get them to actually be themselves.
Peter Ames Carlin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He worked for the Oregonian for a long time. That's how I got to know his name. But he's been working for a long time writing biographies of major figures in music. His newest work is about Paul Simon. It's called Homeward Bound. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the last piece we heard was Paul Simon as True Taylor doing True or False, which was a rockabilly kind of piece, and so how did they make the transition? How did he make the transition? And I guess this was while he was at Queens College, into folk music.
Well, you know, the folk music was coming back into fashion again. You know, starting with the Weavers, you know, Pete Seeger's group, vocal group from the late '40s, early '50s, and that kind of drew people's attention back to this traditional American music that, you know, a lot of people had forgotten. And at the height of the civil rights movement in the, you know, the late '50s and into the early '60s, those stories of simple sort of working people and you know, sort of mixed with gospel music and it became a very evocative type of music, you know, as a soundtrack to the civil rights movement and this sort of labor, this sort of march toward justice. And so, you know, when Paul was at Queens College, kind of the hipper kids were playing folk music. And so even while he was still recording pop music as Jerry Landis on campus, he was becoming interested in the Kingston Trio and Pete Seeger and those types of musicians. And then when Dylan released his first records in 1961 and 1962, you know, Paul became, you know, that swiveled Paul's head even more, and he began to write in that style, too. He wrote a couple early folk songs, one called Carlos Dominguez and another one called He Was My Brother, which was, you know, basically a song about a freedom rider who gets murdered going south to, you know, to work for justice. And oddly, almost eerily, the He Was My Brother song foretold the murder of one of his schoolmates, Andrew Goodman, who was one of the freedom riders who was killed in Mississippi in 1964. Later, Paul began to say that he wrote the song as a result of Goodman's death, but actually, just strangely, it sort of foretold the experience, and then he began to sing the song a little. He changed the words a little bit to make it more specifically about the Andy Goodman murders. It was, you know, Goodman and Cheney and Werner who were murdered that time in 1964, mm-hmm. and that became the subject of, like, Mississippi Burning and was a real turning point in the civil rights movement.
And it's a very gripping song. We actually have a clip of that. I want to hear this, the middle section of He Was My Brother by Paul Simon.
He was singing on his knees. An angry mob trailed along. They shot my brother dead because he hated what was wrong.
It's a song with a lot of impact. It's hard to believe that's the same guy who performed as True Taylor on True or False. How many years apart were those? Like maybe three or four?
He Was My Brother. I think he came. He wrote in 1963. Really, like at the same time, he had put out this goofy pop song called "The Lone Teen Ranger," you know, which actually is sort of a charming tune. But nevertheless, The thing about folk music is that it allowed Paul to kind of reconcile his musical side with his intellectual side. Because even as he was writing and recording these corny pop tunes as Jerry Landis, he was studying poetry and writing and reading literature and history and becoming very engaged intellectually. And I think the folk music allowed him to kind of to sort of combine those two different parts of his, you know, of himself, and that's when his music really became powerful and distinctive, and he really begins to mean what he says. You know, Paul wrote two or three extraordinarily powerful songs about the civil rights movement, and that was what originally brought him the attention of Tom Wilson, the producer at Columbia Records, who was already producing Bob Dylan, and once he heard Sound of Silence and He Was My Brother, he just instantly signed Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, you know. And so it really was an important part of what he did in those very early days. But still, you know, Paul was rarely, hardly ever a writer with a, you know, a political sensibility, which was one of the things that infuriated some of the people who didn't approve of his working with South African musicians in the mid-'80s. You know, why didn't he write a powerful anti-apartheid song on that record? When actually the statement, the anti-apartheid statement, was simply the fact that he came and recorded music with the Native African Americans and brought their music and their humanity to a global audience. You know, and certainly that was Paul's perspective. Other people disagreed, but you know, it became a very powerful thing.
He and Garfunkel got snubbed a bit, it sounds like, by the Greenwich Village folk scene. It sounds like for very similar reasons.
Exactly, because they were so bourgeois. You know, they came from middle-class Queens, and they preferred, these artists who seemed to have more exotic kind of dusty, booted types of backgrounds, you know. Like, for instance, a Ramblin' Jack Elliott, who came from Brooklyn and was actually the son of a well-to-do doctor. His real name is Elliot Adnapose, but he created this whole other identity for himself as this kind of, you know, roustabout cowboy figure, you know, with all these tales to tell. And Bob Dylan came and with his, you know, the sort of mythology about himself, his own sort of self-created tale of growing up on the road and riding the rails, which was sort of an identity he kind of borrowed from Woody Guthrie, when Dylan was also a middle-class Jewish kid from Hibbing, Minnesota. But in Greenwich Village, that was sort of a requirement to have this kind of identity, even though, you know, for Dylan and Ramblin' Jack, it was completely made up. The fact that Paul and Artie didn't bother to make up that kind of identity for themselves really aggravated the folkies. And they sort of had contempt for them, even when Sound of Silence became a hit. But by then it was such a huge hit on the pop charts and the folk rock movement was growing by such leaps and bounds, you know, it didn't matter what Greenwich Village thought of them anymore.
Oh, because people outside thought more highly of it. So in all this, though, you mentioned Paul going to law school while he was still working on music. I mean, so who or what finally hit him upside the head and said, dummy, you should be in music?
Well, it was one of his frat brothers, actually, a really cool young guy that Paul took under his wing, and one of the great acts of generosity in his life. I mean, he had joined this fraternity, and it was like the big winner. You know, it was the Jewish frat at Queens College, but they had a lot of the more popular, powerful kids on campus. Paul very quickly began to move up the authority food chain, and when he was the head of the Rush. The camp, you know, whatever it is, the Fall Rush pledge.
Oh, the Frat Rush, yeah.
He saw this kid who was clearly nothing like any of the other kids. The street kid from a very troubled family in Brooklyn brought him up under his wing, and that guy says Paul changed his life. And when Paul was struggling to pay attention in law school, this guy would watch him trying to study and falling asleep and remembered that the Paul he knew it just a year earlier had been one of the most engaged students that he'd ever met. And so he finally told him, he goes, like, you're wasting your time in law school. You got to do what you love the most. Go back to music.
Which he did. We'll come back and talk more with Peter Ames Carlin about Homeward Bound. Here is Sound of Silence to the break.
I might reach you, but my words like silent raindrops fell. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to a song.
Paul Simon from the Rhythm of the Saints in the that's from Graceland, I'm sorry, in the mid-80s. So Simon making music in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, now the 80s. Peter Ames Carlin has written a biography called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. This is after Peter Ames Carlin's earlier biographies of Brian Wilson and Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the life of Paul Simon. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email jx@jeffnet.org. So how long did Paul hang out in law school before he finally called it quits and said, that's it, it's going to be music full time?
Like, I think a semester and a half.
Uh-huh.
You know, he'd scored really high on the law board exams. Just because he's got that kind of a mind, and so he had all the intellectual tools that you would need to become a very successful lawyer, which you know he would have been. He's smart, ambitious, confrontational to the nth degree. He would have been a perfect lawyer, except for the fact that he just didn't care about it, you know. So the one probably the most crucial tool, which is simply feeling like you could sit down and think about this for the, you know, for a day or a week or a lifetime, was like, didn't exist in his soul. So it was like that was the end of his law career.
We were talking about, you just mentioned confrontational to the nth degree, and you'd mentioned that that Paul can be a bit controlling and obviously wanted nothing to do with this biography. I want to bring this way back, though, because we didn't talk about, I mean, you think about him as a sensitive kind of guy, given the kinds of songs he's written over the years, but he was apparently a bit of a handful on the schoolyard.
Well, you know, he's shorter than most people and always had been, and that was something he felt extremely self-conscious about. And, of course, you know, kids on schoolyards, you know, they make fun of each other, and especially, you know, you find someone's weakness and you just pound away at it. And so for a time, I think he was sort of successfully bullied, but Paul didn't take to bullying very well, and so he just turned right around and figured out how to fight, you know, and he, you know, they'd wipe the hat off of his head, and he'd go after him with his fist balled up, and it wouldn't be long before he got that hat back, you know. And I think Artie talked about how Paul was such a terror on the schoolyard that the teachers were like a little concerned that this little kid was like a sociopath or something. But no, he just was standing up for himself, and you know, and in the rec, you know, I mean, I think he just felt like something in him told him, you're going to have to fight for everything you want. And, you know, and so he's always kind of had that sort of, you know, the fight part of the fight or flight impulse, like, you know, right on the surface through the whole time. And you see him sometimes taking very courageous stands for himself and doing, you know, really standing up for himself in a good way. And sometimes you see him a little bit kind of bullying other people, and you know, and you know, standing up for things that aren't necessarily his to take. And that's a little dismaying. But you know, like all of us, he's shot through with black and white and shades of gray.
Let's take a call. We have Bill in Arcata on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Ames Carlin, the author of Homeward Bound.
Thank you, Jeff. The story about Paul Simon.
Bill, get close to the phone.
Reminds me of another musical lawyer, Cole Porter, at Yale. He wrote the Glee Club script for his year, and after the performance at the cast party, the dean told him, Porter, as a lawyer, you make a terrific songwriter.
All right, I'm going to stop you there because the phone connection is bad. But so another story of somebody, Peter, who was in law school and really didn't belong there.
Yeah, well, Cole Porter, of course, you know, obviously a fabulous musician and an incredible songwriter, and in so many ways, sort of anticipated the career that Paul would have. I mean, Paul worked for a time as a song plugger for Edward Marks' company, and so did Cole Porter. Cole Porter, you know, went to live out on the Channel Islands in Georgia when he wanted to write Porgy and Bess. You know, his sort of opera sort of set in the African-American community, you know, working from African-American music forms, which is beautiful and wonderful, except a lot of people thought it wasn't really Cole Porter's business to be writing and sort of appropriating African-American music in the same way that Paul has been accused of appropriating not just African-American music, but African music with the Graceland album. So then you get this question of authenticity and, you know, an identity and who has the right to do this and who has the right to do that. So much in Cole Porter's life anticipated what would happen in Paul's.
Let's take another call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
I know the time is short, so I'll make this brief. I'd like to ask the author if he could give a little backstory on the song, which to me has always been one of the best songs I've ever heard, which is has the lyric in it, "All Come to Look for America." And, Jeffrey, I'll just take his responses if he has any off the air.
Paul Simon's America. Good question. Thanks for that, Jamie.
Well, it's an incredible song, obviously. I mean, one of the things that you don't think about, but which Paul is rightfully proud of, is that that's one song that includes no rhymes. None of the lines rhyme with any of the others. But it's such an incredibly powerful poem, such a great lyric, that you don't even notice it. It just fits together so naturally. And again, I mean, that's one of the songs that very explicitly draws on that immigrant experience, the idea of people out, wandering in the land, sort of all trying to find the heart of what America is, you know, that essence of what the New World and America and one's identity as an American is supposed to be. But, you know, Paul, in his sort of depressive way, I think also was very conscious of people being isolated from one another. And the song kind of climaxes with this sort of beautiful and yet kind of disturbing image of all these people alone in their cars, zooming as fast as they can for New York City, which of course is the sort of threshold of America for all the immigrants who came from Europe in the 19th and 20th century going through Ellis Island. And they're all searching for the same thing, but they're sort of cut off from one another in their own little bubbles, moving, you know, in the same direction with the same yearning in their souls, but still, you know, sort of separate from one another. You know, it's a song that people immediately associated with the issues of, the mid and late 60s and the kind of, the feeling after the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, not quite getting into, at the threshold of the nearly at the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, but the sense of what happened to this American dream, what happened to Camelot, at the time America seemed to be flying apart at the seams, as it often does feel that way, and Paul really captured something vital that resonated with so many people in that one song.
Another call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Ames Carlin.
Thank you. question, and maybe you already covered it, Paul and Art Garfunkel, what was the story on their breakup? How long were they together, and then what? I don't know whether they were just going different directions or whatever, but tell us about that.
Yeah, was there an explosive moment, something to add to the opera that you described?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it goes back again. I think we spoke about this earlier, about that Paul sort of getting that little secret side solo deal for himself as they were signing, you know, the very first contract to record Hey Schoolgirl when they were in high school. And that same kind of sort of both love for one another and appreciation for one another and this kind of need they had, but also for both of them, very independent people, this deep sense of resentment for having to need one another. You know, it's sort of like, well, you know, at the end of the day, I don't need you and I don't want you around me because I don't want anyone to tell me what I should be doing. So that led to the breakup at the, you know, 1970, early 1971. And, you know, over the years, they have, you know, again and again kind of come back to one another, sometimes more tentatively than other times. They recorded one new song together in 1975, My Little Town, which is a beautiful song. And they did the big, you know, reunion concert at Central Park in 1981, which led to, you know, reunion tours in America and Europe and Asia in the early 80s. And they tried to record a reunion album, but again, that same kind of resentment at sort of needing each other kind of made it so that that didn't work out at all. And they feuded for another 10 years and had kind of a disastrous attempt at a reunion in 1993. And another 10 years later, they got back together, you know, in 2002, 2003 for what was a much more successful reunion, though they never recorded new music together, much to Artie's frustration. And you know, and now they're on the outs again, you know, which is dismaying, I think. And I think that, you know, their relationship has become, I think, emblematic for a lot of baby boom people, a lot of people who grew up with their work, you know, sort of the sound of them together has this sweetness and this perfection, this, you know, this love in the sound of their voices together that remind people of innocence and optimism of youth and that flowering and that sense of mm-hmm. of what can't we do together. And when it falls apart, it's dismaying. It reminds you that life can be dark and ugly, and when they do find that way back to each other, you know, it's this really warm feeling of, well, maybe you can go home again, that this sweetness still exists in the world.
Peter, just about a minute left here. I want to ask, obviously, Bob Dylan just won a Nobel Prize for Literature. Can you see a similar honor in the offing for Paul Simon?
Well, I'm sure Paul Simon hopes so. I mean, he was bitterly, you know, he had a deep resentment for Dylan, and they were always compared to one another in the 60s, and Paul generally was, you know, didn't do well in that comparison. So it was interesting when, you know, I think eventually they became more friendly and they toured together. But when, you know, the day that they announced that that Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature just the other week, it was also Paul's 75th birthday. I mean, coincidentally. So
ouch.
It's like, that had to feel a little ironic for Paul.
No doubt. But wow, what an amazing compilation of information about his life in Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. Peter Ames Carlin wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Peter, good to talk to you, and thanks so much.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care.